Divine Transitions podcast was created to promote individual healing and growth, and to prevent or minimize the depression, anxiety, and frustration that often comes with an LDS faith crisis or awakening. It's my ethical obligation as a licensed psychologist to note that what you're about to hear may sound like psychotherapy, but it's not. It is a practical tool to help you make your journey toward authenticity without sacrificing the best parts of your life. Mormon Transitions is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and relies solely upon the support of people like you, its listeners. To help keep the podcast alive or to become a member of the community, please become a monthly subscriber by visiting mormontransitions.org and clicking on the yellow button on the right side of the page under support. All contributions to Mormon Transitions are completely tax deductible and go towards producing the podcast and building communities and programs of support for Mormons like you. Thanks for your support.
Hi everyone. Tonight I'm going to finish discussing part two of a topic I've wanted a podcast about since we first started Mormon Transitions, because I think it's a fear that we see so commonly in transitioning and alt-Mormon circles, and I want to help allay that fear in any way I can. I firmly believe that one can't make an informed decision that is true to their inner voice when fear is so overwhelmingly strong that it clouds our ability to weigh all aspects of the decision in their individual circumstances. And we hear it so often in our culture. I imagine many of you listening would retire early if you had a penny for every time a parent or sibling or someone else warned you that you need to stay active for your children's sake, because if you don't, who will teach them moral values? For heaven's sake. Or you've probably heard dozens, if not hundreds of times in church or from these same people or priesthood leaders, some cautionary tales of families who left the church or stopped being Orthodox in some way or another, and their children ended up being drug addicts or in jail or got pregnant as teenagers. I'm sure you can recall some of those stories from your not-too-distant memory right now. I know I can. Maybe in your more Orthodox days, you used to share those with others, and I mean, that's okay. We understand. But now you see things differently, and you want to sort this out, because your kids are precious to you, and of course you want what's best for them, or you know, maybe you're a future parent, you're considering having kids someday, and this issue of what am I going to teach my kids? How am I going to tell people about how I'm going to raise them when I get this constant response about, well, how can you possibly do that outside the church? So we're going to launch into that tonight. Let me be clear. This episode is not to convince you one way or the other. Rather, it's to help lessen the fear factor so you can sort it out with a peaceful mind. And let me also be clear, this is not an episode I would advise sharing with your Orthodox family or friends or just anyone. I mean, all those who warned you to stay Orthodox for your children's sake, you know, don't send this to them to say, you know, see my way of thinking or, you know, my decision is best for my kids. You know, this podcast confirms it. Like, please don't. Because in general, I think doing that with any book or podcast is a bad idea. But especially this one, this episode is not for them. It's not to change anyone's mind because, and I repeat this a lot in my podcast, trying to change another person's mind rarely works, and almost 100% of the time it backfires. You know, that said, if you feel it fits in your individual circumstance, I guess I can see a way of sharing this as being productive to share with a loved one who disagrees, but only as a way for them to see what's going on in your head, you know, your thought processes, maybe. You know, as long as you make it very clear that you have no intention of changing their mind at all, you know, that they know what's right for their life and you know what's right for yours, and you won't persuade them. You mean you wouldn't be able to persuade them anyway. It's only to help them see where your headspace is, to understand your thinking better, you know, even though they couldn't disagree more, and that's okay. So, all that said, this episode really is for you. The misfits, the ones that feel like a square peg trying to fit into a round hole, you know who you are. It's for you to have more peace of mind with a big decision you're thinking of making sometime in the future, or maybe you already have, and yet sometimes you might second-guess yourself. Doubt may creep in. I mean, after decades of hearing from authority figures that you're doing all the right things, you're on the right track, and you know, that was the way to gauge your progress in life, all of a sudden, you're not hearing that external validation anymore. And while I think that, you know, internal validation is the way to go from here on out, hearing your inner voice that says, yes, this feels like the right path for me, this is good, and that's what I mean. So, you're going from an external to internal validation is a process in and of itself, and sometimes we could use a little cheerleading that, no, you're not wrong for listening to your heart, and for doing something that feels right, like weighing these possibilities. There's more than one side to the issue, of course, and that issue is, like I said earlier, raising your children without church orthodoxy. Whether that's immersed in unorthodoxy that you provide at home, you know, some people call that home church or alt church or mountain church, or leaving orthodoxy by leaving the church, or perhaps taking a break until further notice. You know, that's all up to you. I'm not invested in any of those decisions as better or worse than another. What I am interested in is helping you navigate the process as healthfully as possible and without fear or shame. So, here we go. And this is going to be just me tonight. I'm flying solo. Part two is following up on a practical case example from part one. My friend Emily bravely came on with me last week to share her story and how she's parenting post-orthodoxy in Utah County, of all places, which I imagine we talked about it, it's pretty orthodox out there. But tonight is more nuts and bolts. It's an educational component where I'll be talking about the research out there and the psychology behind things that people say and the decisions we make. Because I think it's important to know at the outset that this fear that you're going to mess up your kid's life if you make the wrong decision, or other people's fear of that for you, is based on a very primal feeling that is, to an extent, evolutionary. And it's the same part of your brain that gets triggered in your loved one's brain when they think about the effect of you leaving, and then saying things like stories of people who left and their kids are now in jail or whatever. They do that in an effort to persuade you, you know, as you know. I mean, neurologically speaking, it's our tribal nature. It's primal. It's how humans survived thousands of years ago. You stick with the tribe, you survive. You defy the tribe or tribal norms, then you get kicked out and you die. Literally. I mean, now that we've progressed beyond, you know, the hunter-gatherer stage, I mean, death isn't on the table. Though, you know, you may hear the occasional commentary, and I'm remembering a certain line that showed up in Freaks and Geeks, that TV show, I don't know if you know, it's one of my favorites. Anyway, where the dad at the dinner table brings up people who do things he doesn't like or doesn't want his kids to do. He always follows their story up with, and do you know what happened to them? They died. And so, you know, it's not just a Mormon thing. However, that tribal instinct is embedded into our neuroanatomy. So, I mean, at the top of our brain, we've got the smartest and most agile parts, the prefrontal cortex, which thinks and analyzes and weighs long-term decisions like staying or leaving, is one example. And then there's the hippocampus, which makes and holds on to our immediate memories, like, wow, church is painful. At the bottom is the basal ganglia, nearly identical to the brain of lizards, controlling voluntary but barely conscious actions. So this is the part of the brain that cares what other people think, because being accepted in the tribe is critical to survival, and it sweats if any thoughts or actions are a threat to your status of belonging there. So I mean, all this to say, it's normal and expected that you're going to sweat through this fear. The question is, how do we negotiate this balance between what the basal ganglia at a primal level is wiring us to react to with our frontal lobe, you know, the part that processes data and makes long-term decisions? So let's dissect this primal fear a little, just one piece at a time. One part is an assumption that giving your kid a religious upbringing goes hand in hand with living a moral life, like being a good person. And as some of you are probably already aware, there's been some research to make this connection not so cut and dry at all, challenging what we hear so often from well-meaning family, friends, and others, missionaries, all those well-meaning people. The most famous study was done last year, in fact, in 2015. It involved 1,150 children, which I must say, as a researcher, is a pretty impressive sample size. It was done with kids in 6 countries, so Canada, China, Jordan, Turkey, South Africa, and the U.S. It included 510 Muslim, 280 Christian, and 323 non-religious children. The study was the first to take a real large-scale look at how religion and moral behavior intersect in children from around the globe, and it focused on one facet of moral behavior, and that's altruism. And you know, the definition is the willingness to give someone else a benefit that also comes with a personal cost. So the test revolved around, of course, the objects that are most important to kids, even more so than money, and that is stickers. Children from ages 5 to 12 met individually with adults who let them choose 10 of their favorite stickers. The children were then told that the adults didn't have time to distribute the rest of their stickers to the other kids in the class, but each child was told they could put some of their 10 stickers in an envelope to share with other kids who were described as being from the same school and ethnic group. The scientists used the number of stickers left in the envelope as a measure of altruism. The children from non-religious households left 4.1 stickers on average, which was a statistically significant difference from the Christian and Muslim children, which were 3.3 and 3.2 on average stickers, respectively. So another important piece to this fear, in my opinion, is the assumption that our parenting is super crucial to how our children end up as adults. So we better do it right. I mean, I know I've felt that way many times. We could do a whole episode on the effects of the perfectionistic culture wreaking havoc on aspects of our lives as adults, and one aspect of that being parenting. And I actually might do an episode on that in the future. But tonight we're going to focus on, you know, just how much of our kids, how they turn out, is related to our parenting in actuality. And the answer is, according to current research, not much, if any, at all, really. And that seems pretty counterintuitive, and I'm going to qualify it in just a second, but that's something to... In Mormon parlance, to ponderize, if you will. Because seriously, for better or worse, your parenting really doesn't matter in how your children end up as adults. And this is barring cases of abuse and neglect, I might add. Because abuse and neglect definitely have an effect. They, you know, obviously a negative effect, a severe effect. I'm not talking about abuse or neglect when I say there's not much of an influence in your parenting choices and how they turn out. What I am talking about are parenting decisions like what we're talking about tonight, like what religion you raise them in, if any. I think this is difficult to process, because On one hand, it could help you feel a little better and take some pressure off because, you know, what you decide to do about your faith journey potentially really isn't going to matter too much in who your children become and the good or the bad decisions that they make. That's, in a way, it's not your fault. If your kids grow up to be a bad person, it's like, well, yeah, it's not my fault. On the other hand, though, for type A personalities like myself, who feel like we want to be in control of most situations, it takes some getting used to wrap your mind around and stretches you with practicing mindfulness and the art of letting go, because it doesn't matter what you do to an extent. Like I said earlier, neglect and abuse absolutely matters. Don't do that. Genetics play an insanely large role, as we know from twin studies, and what environmental factors do exist, like I said, barring any abuse and neglect, the environment that counts most is your kids' peer groups. And I know what you're probably anticipating hearing from people who don't agree with you. And again, gentle reminder, that's why this episode is not for them. You might be thinking, well, they'd respond, well, raising them in the church, raising your kids in the church lets them grow up with good Mormon kids who don't do all those worldly things. And so, yeah, we want them in a Mormon, Orthodox Mormon peer group. But I bet enough of you listening can already think about examples of Mormon kids in your high schools who did some really, really horrible things or exercised pretty bad judgment. So, simple answer that you might get from people about, guaranteeing good peer groups doesn't really cut it. I mean, like all things, nothing is that simple. It's friend roulette, in a sense. I mean, the answer is it's actually really complicated, and you don't have a terrible amount of control over who your kids' peer groups are. And if you tried really hard to force them into the ones you like, it will probably backfire. So the best you can do is to just be unconditionally loving and educate about safe practices, and then let them make their own decisions on friends and such, with the comfort of knowing that if they do slip up, you'd be a safe person that they can talk to, as opposed to them hiding it from you. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Earlier on, I mentioned twin studies. Let me get into specifics a little to put your mind at ease, I hope. And maybe it won't initially, if you're a type A like myself. But I want to put your mind at ease about how little parenting decisions could factor in your child's personalities. And let me qualify here. I mean temperament and personalities, not necessarily behavior, especially when they're young. Because, like that earlier study on altruism suggested, for kids, that the religious environment you raise them in could affect the kind and altruistic behavior that your kid exhibits when they're young, which I think is good practice for an adulthood. That's sure. I mean, it's important. But I'm talking more in terms of their personality or their temperament, which is actually pretty stable over the lifespan. And it solidifies in our early 20s when the frontal lobe finishes growing. So no matter what choices you make about orthodoxy as a parent, your kids' personality is going to do what it's going to do, really. I'm actually a textbook example of this, I think. I mean, my parents did everything they could to raise me in a completely orthodox environment. Seriously, they left no stone unturned, and I ended up being the way I am, questioning authority and such. So I'm just one of thousands of examples of orthodox families who churn out kids who march to the beat of their own drum anyway. But I digress again. Let's focus on twin studies. The methods of twin researchers have been around for decades and have been challenged, critiqued, refined, adjusted, and cross-validated with other techniques that rely on different assumptions entirely. They work, and they work with impressive precision. You know, based on the results of classical twin studies, it just doesn't appear that parenting, for example, whether mom and dad are permissive or not, whether they read to their kids or not, or you know, whatever else, if they're in the church or not, that impacts development as much as we might like to think it does. So regarding cross-validation, studies examining identical twins separate at birth and reared apart have repeatedly revealed in shocking ways the same thing, that these individuals, these twins, are remarkably similar when they should be utterly different, you know, you would think, because they have completely different environments, they grew up in very different settings and with different parenting styles, but they share the same genes. These twins share the same genes. So, alternatively, non-biologically related adoptive children, so children who have no genetic commonalities, raised together, you know, under the same roof, same parents, they're utterly different from each other. You know, despite, you know, in many cases, having decades and decades of exposure to the same environment, and parental environment to be specific. So, Judith Rich Harris wrote a book that I'm going to link into this episode's post called The Nurture Assumption, and this is an absolute must read, in my opinion, and I'll never forget it. This was the very first assignment and lecture that I was ever given my first day of school as a freshman at BYU in Psychology 101. So first day of class, Dr. Hal Miller, you know, gave us this article and he said, we're going to talk about parenting. So we're going to discuss how little parenting matters. And I mean, that threw a lot of students off, but these are good challenges to our assumptions. Anyway, as you know, Harris says in her book, parents are not to blame for their children's neuroses beyond the genes they contribute to the manufacturing of that child, of course. Well, they're not solely to blame for those neuroses, so nor can they take much credit for their kids' successes. You know, to put a finer point on what Harris argued, children do not transport the effects of parenting like how orthodox they were raised outside the home. So the socialization of children certainly matters because, you know, it's important to remember that neither personality nor temperament is 100% heritable. So it's not all in the genes, but it's not the parents who are the primary socializers, like I said earlier. That honor goes to the child's peer group. And that's where I'm going to share a completely anecdotal and personal experience in my own childhood and adolescence. So take it with a grain of salt. I just love, you know, I'm a storyteller, so here goes a personal experience. I have my own biases, which will be apparent very soon on peer groups, and who knows if it'll work for my own kids. I'm just going to open up about, you know, what I'm thinking because I'm a parent of four myself. So here it goes. My mom, when I was young, tried really hard to help me be a popular kid. Like, you know, like a lot of parents do. They want their kids to be liked and you know, run with a popular crowd sometimes. And even, you know, to the extent of arranging sleepovers or parties with these girls, and not just in school, the popular crowd in school, but also in primary and young women's. So anyway, she tried, but it didn't work. And I naturally tended to gravitate toward the bookworms, the geeks, you know, if I may, because, you know, I identify as one. So yeah, those were the peers that I tended to relate to and who I eventually made my own. These were my people, the nerds, the geeks. They didn't judge me. They welcomed me just as I was. And, you know, we didn't drink or do drugs or any of that because, we were too busy researching, you know, potential grad schools that we wanted to get into during lunch. And after school, I was kind of ridiculous, but, these habits or the lack thereof, you know, since I didn't do drugs or drink, it had nothing to do with the church, because, you know, even though a couple of those friends I knew from church, because we coincidentally took Latin together, for the most part, these peers weren't. They weren't members of the church. In fact, my two best friends were atheist and Lutheran, and they're all widely successful adults. All this to say, personally, I would love for my kids to hang out with the nerds and the geeks rather than focus on religious affiliation, but I say that recognizing that I have little to no control over that happening or not. I mean, what if one of my kids doesn't really enjoy academics at all? I've got to be okay with that, just like I wish with every fiber of my being that Mormon parents everywhere, and many are, to give them the benefit of the doubt, I just wish that these Mormon parents everywhere could be okay with their kids just not being very into Mormonism and to not treat them any differently. Because here's what some research is saying that gets actually pretty interesting, and I think it's backed up with common sense that, you know, if we're talking strictly about drugs, alcohol, and smoking as a measure of a kid's good and bad behavior, you know, that, which is a discussion all to itself, but, you know, there's some limited research, and some of it's outdated, and the sample sizes are pretty small for what it's worth. Anyway, this research is showing that kids who self-identify as more religious are less likely to smoke, for example, you know, one specific behavior, smoking. But here's the thing that at least one study reported. Once a kid had tried smoking just once, the differences washed away. So in other words, how religious they were no longer became a protective factor, and they smoked just as much as non-religious peers, which I think speaks to the scared straight factor. I'm thinking of Arrested Development now. I mean, I replay my life in TV shows sometimes, so the scared straight factor that some of us, you know, myself included, grew up with to an extent, you know, being way too scared of what would happen to us if we dabbled into any of that or to even try it, which, I mean, common sense also tells us is a pretty dangerous outcome to rest your entire parenting life choices on about church activity, you know, because so many factors as parents we have no control over. First, that one study only mentioned how religious the youth reported themselves to be, not how they were raised. And like I said earlier, we can all think of examples of kids who were raised super orthodox, and yet it didn't really rub off on them. You know, it wasn't their thing. And their parents were, you know, understandably upset or wringing their hands, like, you know, having an Alma the Younger moment, like, oh, my kid is so rebellious, what have we done wrong? You know, and beyond that, you know, as a psychologist and a parent, this is super important to me because, you know, sure, there's, you know, a slightly better chance that if your kids decide to go the religion route, and again, we have no control over whether they decide to go the religion route or not. Even if there's a tiniest chance that they won't experiment with smoking, drugs, or alcohol if they self-identify as religious, you know, what if they try it once? Like, you know, they get pressured by a friend and they do it. You know, that's where I think orthodoxy can backfire, because if I've just noticed that kids who come from really orthodox backgrounds, if they do engage in behavior that they fear might disappoint their parents or the church, they're less likely to tell you about it. And, you know, so they could be doing it secretively and engaging in risky behavior and hiding, can have really, really bad outcomes and spiral out of control real easily. You know, and contrast that to, you know, your kids coming clean with you so you can get them the help they need. And not just in terms of getting help, but there's some interesting research that the principle of unconditional forgiveness can serve as a protective factor for kids being less likely to drink. Now, this study looked specifically at drinking behavior. This one study had a sample size of 305, so it's not bad, but not great. But anyway, they gave teenagers who checked into hospitals some measures on religiosity and spirituality to see if there's any interaction between beliefs and drinking. And those who actually believed in the principle of forgiveness were less likely to drink as much as teens that were religious and non-religious, both, for whom forgiveness wasn't such a big part of their belief system. So, I mean, they dissected, you know, these different beliefs and tried to tease out, you know, some statistically significant differences. And, and unconditional forgiveness, that was the only one that they found to be a protective factor. I thought that was fascinating. We can go on and on about how our culture of origin can be pretty legalistic and works heavy and doesn't focus so much on grace or forgiveness. I mean, for me, a certain analogy Elizabeth Smart remembered comes to mind about chewed gum and chastity. And I remember one in Sunday school about how it's important to repent of your sins, but even when you do, the effects still linger and you're never the same. Like food coloring being dropped into a glass pitcher of water. Some of you may have gotten this object lesson too. But anyway, there's food coloring being put in a pitcher of water. But there's no way to get out the red color completely, even if you put dish soap or something else. I can't remember the exact thing, but once you put another chemical in it, you know, it does clear up, but not completely. So, you know, and that was a way to say there's no way to for unconditional, going back just the way you were, which could be pretty tough for a teenager to hear, and children too. The Not Even Once Club, I don't know if some of you remember that train wreck. I mean, it was a children's book by Elder Nelson and his wife. It was called the Not Even Once Club. Don't get me started on that. But all that to say, research is fascinating. And please, like I said earlier, do not use it to send to friends and family to convince them that your point of view is the right one, because it never works. This info is to help allay any fears you might have about stepping into the unknown and out of orthodoxy and the self-doubt that comes with that when you're hearing all your life how you'll ruin your life and the lives of your children and grandchildren for generations if you even entertain this idea of going off script or leaving. So feel free to re-listen to this throughout the years after a family reunion or whenever you're getting a particularly long call to repentance email, for example, and those feelings of self-doubt start to creep in again. It's always here when you want it, this podcast. So what I'm here to say is it's not so cut and dry. What matters more than anything, definitely in my opinion, more than what religion you choose for them is that your children know you love them unconditionally, and that they know, not just by word, but by deed, that they can come to you with anything and you won't judge them and you'll forgive them, no strings attached. This is super helpful for the relationship, regardless of how they turn out. Because as research seems to indicate, you know, focusing on a positive, strong relationship is a smart way to focus, rather than on behavioral or personality outcomes. Because as a parent, you know, your parenting style seems to not matter so much in the shaping of their personality or traits. Because I like to include a practical piece that listeners can take away, I'm just going to give one example of how to do that. You know, one thing that you can do to make a big difference in your relationship with your kids, regardless of what faith journey you take, is to very explicitly repeat to them from a very young age, even if they are like, oh, mom, dad, you gotta say that again. No, this is important. So feel free to repeat this from as they're as little or as young to be able to remember it. I mean, I'm thinking 3 or 4. But anyway, to say something like, look, I just want you to know that you can come to me to tell me anything. Even if you think it's wrong and that I'd be mad, I promise you I won't be mad. And it won't change how much I love you or what I think of you. Not one little bit. There's nothing that you can say or do that would change how I feel about you or how I'll treat you. So you can always tell me the truth. Don't be afraid. Now, if you do that and live it, even if initially it might feel like a lie because, hey, you might actually be disappointed initially, a little, especially if you yourself were raised pretty orthodox or conservatively. But this is key. Try to work that out on your own beforehand so it doesn't bleed into how you treat your child. And in a case like this, as the adage goes, fake it till you make it. Continue, and to repeat over the years, continue to always insist that you won't be mad or upset if they come to you with anything. And that because of that, they can always tell you the truth. And then, watch your relationship flourish and deepen with them. Okay, so that's an example of something you can say to your kids from the time when they're little, on repeat. So you can do that to maintain a good relationship with them. Now, let me just end with some ideas of things that you can say when family and friends ask you if you've thought about how you're going to raise your kids with good morals outside of Mormon Orthodoxy. And this is crowdsourced from other fellow transitioners, with the caveat that you can really say whatever you want, because no matter how many facts you give them, they'll probably stick to their previously held beliefs about how you need the church to raise good kids, most don't really want to know the answer to that question. They ask it almost as a reflex, and try not to hold it against them, because I know at least in my case, it wasn't that long ago when I thought the same way they did. So here's some examples of what to say when these people ask, well, how are you going to raise your kids with good morals? You can say, Jesus wasn't raised LDS, and he turned out okay. You could answer the question with a question, like, do you think only good and moral people in this world are Mormon? And if they say no, you can say, well, my kid will be one of those people. And if they say yes, as in only good and moral people in this world are Mormon, then, you've got bigger problems, I think, to sort out. And hopefully they would not say yes. That would give them pause to think about. Anyway, another response to the question, how are you going to raise your kids to be moral outside of Orthodoxy or outside of the church, is, saying, well, the same way that 99.999% of humans living in the world manage to do. So there's another one. And I thought this one was interesting. Someone said they would want to respond, the church's morals and standards can no longer live up to our own as a family. So, that was, their personal experience. I mean, it's different for everyone, like I always say in these podcast episodes. So, here's another one. They said, we've been very open with our kids about what we don't believe, but we also have tried to replace that with what we do believe instead. So we made our own family articles of faith that they shared with curious or family members or onlooking family members who asked that question about, how can they be moral? So, and then they said that their kids have really liked knowing that what we do agree with and not just what upsets us. So, to all the parents and prospective parents out there, you can do this. You know, you're not alone. The struggle is real, but we'll make it out all right, and so will your kids. So whatever you decide. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Transitions. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us make more like it by becoming a subscriber at mormontransitions.org. Music for this episode was provided by Iris Dement.
Some say they're going to a place called glory, and I ain't saying it ain't a fact. But I've heard that I'm on the road to purgatory, and I don't like the sound of that. Well, I believe in love and I live my life accordingly. But I choose to let the mystery be. Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worried about where they're gonna go.